Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Bill.
And we welcome you aboard the Had to Go Out podcast. Before we dive into this episode, we need to provide a disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast are those of the individuals involved and are not to be construed as official or reflecting the views of any government agency or military service. This podcast is an independent effort with no government association.
When the most is expected, the brave men and women of the U.S. Coast Guard are always ready. The National Coast Guard Museum will engage, educate, and inspire visitors by honoring the courage and skill of our nation's unsung armed service. The museum will explore the Coast Guard's rich history and current impact through interactive exhibits, STEM-based learning experiences, and leadership development programming. Find out how you can join the effort. Become a plank owner today. Visit CoastGuardMuseum.org/out. That's CoastGuardMuseum.org/OUT.
All right. Hey, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Had to Go Out podcast. Thanks for joining us today. Thanks for everybody that's tuning in on YouTube. We've got a live one for you today. That's what we're going to try and bring more to you on the video platform, and I think we got that. So, again, thanks for watching, and please subscribe if you haven't already.
Yeah, thanks everybody for being here. If it's your first time, really glad you found it. If you just found us on YouTube, please subscribe. We hit that first threshold so that we can do this live now. Let us know how it's going. Hit us up on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, wherever. Type in They Had to Go Out. Find us. Tell us what you want, what we can do more of, what you'd like to see, and please subscribe. And looking forward to this episode today. This is going to be a cool one.
Yeah, obviously there's some perks to doing it live that right. You know, we had no idea of, but our guest today definitely hooked us up. So again, thank you guys.
Tough location.
Very tough location. Hey, so today we're coming to you from Primo Cigars and Coffee out in Norfolk, Virginia. And who we have with us is Mr. Mike Vecchione.
I got it right.
Yeah,
good job.
Not quite spelled the way it sounds, but close. So Mike Vecchione, born and raised out in Mount Laurel, New Jersey, joined the Coast Guard back in 1998 with Company Echo 153. First operational unit, Coast Guard Cutter Venturous out of St. Pete, Florida. Then went to Station Cortez as a BM3, made BM2 there, transferred to the International Training Division out of Yorktown, now called the Mobile Training Branch. Went from there to the Aquidneck in CENTCOM, or Pat Forsois, as we now call it. Then to Station South Portland. We got to talk about how you went from, I'm sure, a priority
one
transfer.
You were priority one. South Portland was,
we'll talk about it. Yeah.
The detailer was surprised, too.
Yeah. And then did a rate change out in South Portland to Maritime Enforcement Specialist. Transferred from there to Maritime Safety and Security Team, New York. Was on the FP team there, and then transferred to the Maritime Security Response Team out in Chesapeake, where he made MEC and retired just recently after 20 years of active service. So we thank you, Mike, for being
thank
on.
You. Thank
I'm
you.
I'm going to let Bill ask her question as I drink some Primo coffee. Yeah,
thanks for having us. Yeah, thanks for letting us be here in this location.
You're drinking French pressed Southern Whiskey coffee from Pale Horse.
It doesn't have whiskey in it.
And
no, it does
good.
Not. It's Southern
it's
Whiskey.
Good.
Flavor
but it's
infused.
Really good. I'm going to take a sip and then I'll ask
it's
the question.
Almost like you could be at work and you could be drinking whiskey while not drinking whiskey.
You're it's right.
It's got that barrel flavor.
And I picked that because you guys told me you were BM.
It's so. Perfect. I love it. Perfect.
All right. So now that we've BS'd our way through and put in a plug for the coffee, which is important, Mike, what's your most dangerous, daring, or epic sea story or stories?
See, when you asked me, like, kind of beforehand, I was like, alcohol related or not, joking right. around. But of course, told.
I think really the story we need to hear is what was her name that got you to South Portland from Air Force One.
Actually, believe it or not, it was female related.
So no surprise.
Yeah, the detailer combo, that whole combo was a trip. He couldn't believe it, but we'll get into that. No, I think I don't even say daring rescue. I just think for me, like my the most memorable rescue I had was as a coxswain at Station Cortez, and you guys remember, back in like the early 2000s, even pre-9/11, the stations more or less ran their own SAR cases as long as it wasn't multi-unit. So as an
OSP,
in the days of groups,
in the days of group, Group St. Petersburg. So as a group OOD, you basically just would kind of call them and check in. But as the OOD of the station, you ran your case.
Right.
So at the time, I was. I was OD, and then the first boat went out, and it was an overturned catamaran that, that was drifting. They couldn't find
it. Tell us about real quick, what's Station Cortez? What's it like? Like, what kind of boat you got?
I don't even know what they have now. Back then, we had a 41. 41370. We had the first.
That's not there anymore.
That's definitely not there.
No, of course not. We had the first Coast Guard 25. It was 252525. And then they had a.
We got really original on that number.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, it's like not 250001. It was just 2525. And then they had the Boston Whalers, one of the old school Boston Whalers.
Okay.
So I think towards the end when I was leaving, they were supposed to be getting. Well, they got one of the new 25s.
Because you had the old HS model.
Yeah,
they had the seat in back that had zero shock whatsoever.
Yeah. And actually, that one had two seats inside, and then the door, and it didn't even have back seats. It had these little
the benches.
Weren't even benches; they were just like a hump that you just kind of sat on, and then closed the door, and you were like this, And I'm small, so I can't imagine the bigger dudes would usually just stand with the door open, put their hands on the seats, which is why we all have bad knees now.
Yep. Right.
So I went out a second boat for the case, and I remember being underway OD, and I called the chief. And they were basically, but that was back when they would put all your search patterns in, in the computer at the group, and then when they would give them, to you, and it would be like overland or over, like they didn't make sense.
Sure.
And
it hasn't changed.
I'm sure it hasn't. So I just remember being like with local knowledge. Just there's a nasty rip current that would go off the beach, and I was thinking in my head like an overturned catamaran. You're gonna have a sail underwater.
Right.
It's gonna act like a drogue, and it's gonna pick up that current,
right.
And it's not gonna drift with the direction of the wind. And overturned catamaran, what your surface area is like nothing. You know what I mean?
Right,
pretty much the people.
Man, I love that you became an ME, but you're still talking like.
Yeah, you're a buzzer.
I got the whole fast on it.
Yeah, nice. I love it.
So I ended up going out on their first search pattern, and I was awaiting the second search pattern, and they wanted me to go south, and I'm like, or no, they wanted me to go to north, and the current went south, and I'm like, there's no way that boat went north. I'm like, we're gonna go away from these people. So I'm not saying that I disregarded the search pattern that they sent me. I will say that I may have started my search pattern earlier than they gave me theirs.
Oh, right. You didn't have information, so you had to work with what
you knew. Of course.
Right.
And then while they were giving me their search pattern, I was like, well, let me finish the one I'm on.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So I ended up doing my search pattern, which is a completely different area, and ended up finding the people.
Weird.
Weird, right?
So what you're saying is that the guy on scene with local knowledge was able to figure stuff out that people in a room with no windows
and of course.
I think you're jumping on board with this.
I've always been on board with it, Phil.
So I, although it wasn't like this daring sea rescue where obviously, I put my coxswain letter on the line, that's for sure.
Absolutely.
Because I did call the chief, and he even told me, this is going to either get you like a medal, or it's going to get you, you're going to lose your qual.
This is a con or an Article 15, right? Yeah. It only goes two ways.
So I ended up doing that. That was pretty cool.
Cool.
Those people ended up being like, I don't know, they were like donors to Jeb Bush, I think, in Florida. So they ended up writing a letter to the White House, and I got a letter from President Bush. Like, it was like a thank you letter, basically. And I thought that was pretty cool.
That is really
cool. Just kind of neat, like, because I rescued this family, and they were like, oh, because I'm thinking, if we had gone north, these people would have been, they'd have been in, the Bahamas. So that was pretty cool. I had some cool little stories here and there, but nothing,
I really want to hear about Maine.
Alright.
I'm stuck on it.
Well, no, because you guys know, what's the number one unit that people gun for out of Papersville as a BMR?
Lake Tahoe.
Lake Tahoe, right? So
look at that, I knew that.
Of course.
Nothing
so, at the time, the BM1 that was on the cycle before me on the Aquidneck, he picked up Lake Tahoe on his cycle. So I'm like 6 months later when I transferred, I know it's not going to be open. So you guys are going to kill me when you find out the orders that I had. You're like, what? Whoa. But they gave me, at the time when the BM1s were still in charge of St. Croix, they gave me that billet, which...
MSD St. Croix, which is, it's like you and two other guys.
Yeah, right. And like Hawaiian shirts and a 25.
And underway.
So I was like, man, this is going to be so cool. And I was married at the time. So I called her and told her, and she was like, well, I'm going to go to school, and I don't know if there's a good school out there, and I don't want to be that far away from family, and we're going to be isolated on an island. And I'm like, yeah, but it's an island. And it's so cool there. Yeah, like, so long story short, what happened is, it was actually two things. I knew that I wanted to become an ME because of my background at Station Cortez doing LE, and before they had stood up the MSSTs and the FP teams, they put a bunch of the people from the groups into like a lot of WASU training. Right. So I was one of those guys that went through a lot of WASU training that, you know, I don't think anybody even talks about anymore. And then, because as soon as the MIST teams came out, they like did away with all that stuff. What they did is they took two people from each station and put us at the group as what is now a Sector VBS team.
Yeah. Right.
But back then they didn't have that.
They had
a group LEO, one guy, and they had a BM1 at the group that was like assistant LEO for the group. And then we were like his boarding team. So I was one of the guys from the station. So I knew I really liked that stuff. And I loved ITD. I loved the traveling and all the stuff we did around the world, you know. And of course, you hear ITD was, you know, the precursor of what they were before they were ITD. You hear all those stories, and I was like, man, I really want to get into this like special ops stuff. And I also had Screen for XPO, so it was like I had done enough as a BM. I was a deck watch officer, where like my career could have gone either way.
Right.
So it was like
they were pretty, singing at Eton.
Pretty much what the pretty much what the detailer told me. He said if you take an XPO job, and I guess kind of a good thing that happened, I missed the screening for XPO at Pat Forsois, and I say I missed as in my CO never put my stuff out, and he was late, and since he was late, I didn't get screen for XPO.
It's like a Bob Ross happy accident is the way it ended.
Exactly, happy accident. So I ended up getting the island billet, the dream island billet, and I'm like, hey, that's a cool job, right? And he's like, yeah, from there, man, you'll screen for XPO, you'll be good. So then I was like, well, if I screen for XPO, what if I want to go NE? He's like, well, if you're an XPO, you ain't gonna hit ME.
You're not getting out of rate.
You're not getting out of rate. So I was like, huh, okay. So then I was like, what if I don't want that billet? And he's like, I'd call you crazy. And I was like, what do you have for an ops boss job stateside? And he was like, South Portland, Maine. And I was like, what else? And he's like, South Portland, Maine.
You said, I'll get my jacket.
And he goes, you can go to the Caribbean or you can go to South Portland, Maine. And he's like, I want you to sleep on it. Don't give me the answer now.
Right.
You
know?
And I said, okay. So the next day I met up with him and I said, you're going to think I'm crazy. And he's like, I knew you were going to pick it. And I'm like, send me to South Portland, Maine. I will say, cool city.
I'll be honest with you, I would choose South Portland, Maine over St. Croix.
Awesome city. I will tell you.
I, however, would not.
I understand.
No way you
I like snow.
I do too, but after 1 year up there, and I'm not a big winter guy, but after 1 year up there, I was actually sad to leave. Like, I really enjoyed South Portland. Right. I was like, man, I'm really getting into the city. It was so much fun. But, no, so I went the ops boss job because I knew it would be easier to get out of the rain.
Right.
And I knew I was going to jump ship as an ME. So I did. And luckily, when I was there, originally it was like, hey, wherever you're at, you got to finish. And I'm thinking, shit, I'm going to finish 4 years here. I'm only going to have 5 years left as an ME. And I'm going to be old. And I was already starting to hurt.
Old and starting to break.
Yeah. So I'm like,
being a bosun mate breaks.
So luckily, he called me and he's like, hey, Miss New York has an open spot for their team chief. He's like, I know you're a first, but you know, you can. They'll take a first that is a hard charger. And since you're coming as a BM from like a command rate, you know, they'll take you. So I was like, dope. So I went and did the tryout. I did the tier one. I did all that stuff.
Yep.
And eventually the brokenness caught up with me. Yep. So, and here I am.
Very cool.
Broken retired.
Right.
What else?
I'd say you're living your best life as I'm sitting here.
Yeah, I know.
It's not bad.
You're doing all right.
Doing okay.
So you said that you were in LE at Station Cortez, and that kind of like started it for you?
Yeah.
What happened down in Cortez that kind of kicked off that spirit?
It was really even before, like, nothing really happened. I just, as soon as I started getting into the BTM stuff, I just, like, even on the Cutter, I mean, we had we did the Motor Vessel Cons drug bust. At the time, it was one of the bigger drug busts the Coast Guard had done.
How did that go down?
10,500 pounds. The drugs were actually, it was cocaine hidden under loose iron ore, which was a lot of digging.
Yeah, sure.
And a lot of red clothes. But the, it was cool because I was just getting into it, and I was a BTM, and I was like a boat crew member, and we were, you know, we were on the slow, the old slow four-cylinder Volvo Penta ribs, and we're chasing drug boats and getting our asses handed to us, but I still loved it.
Right.
And I was like, man, I really wanna do this. And when I got to the station, became a BO, it was like a passion. Right. And anything that I am passionate about, I put everything into. So just the LE stuff, I was out doing boardings all the time, like 20, 25 a day. All the guys that were above me at the time.
You, didn't they?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, some of the other BOs were like, yo, tone it down a little bit.
Right, that's what I mean.
You're making us look bad. Because then the chief would go, Vecchio did 25 boardings on Saturday, why can't you go do it? Right. And they're like, killing me, dude. Yeah.
When you say 25, you mean five?
So it was a fun time, and then 9/11 happened, you know, and then of course it was, I'll never forget that. I was at the group for, they used to have a training called Super User Training. So,
I'm trying to think if I know.
Before we had ITs, you know, we had basically Windows, I think we were on like Windows 98 at the time. They needed somebody at each unit that could be trained up to troubleshoot the basic Windows things. So they sent you to this
little...
You
loved LE.
So you were
if you volunteered to go to the help desk tier one school,
yeah.
That's loving LE.
Yeah, right, I did. So help desk tier one. So I went, and it was kind of a pain in the ass at the time. I'm glad that the ITs came around, because then constantly people hit me up, hey dude, my Outlook won't sync. Hey dude, and I'm like, God, leave me alone. So I was there at 9/11 happened during the school, and I'll never forget, it was like the last day. And we're sitting there at the training, and somebody's like on CNN, on the website, which you're not supposed to be surfing the web, but he was bored and was reading the news.
Right.
And then he was just like his color just flushed from his face. And we were all like, what the fuck are you doing? And then the guy teaching the class was like, you're not supposed to be on the internet. And this kid stood up and was like, the World Trade Center just got blown up. And everyone was like, what? And like just then, somebody came into the room and was like, who here is weapons qualified? So it was only like me and a couple other BMs that were in there. The rest were like from support units, like HSs and stuff. So I was like, I am. And they're like, go grab an M16. And at St. Pete, there's like a little airport.
Okay.
So they were like, stand along the fence line with an M16. And I'm like, for what? And they're like, anybody tries to get on a plane and take off, or anybody lands a plane, you have weapons authority. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, what the hell's going on? So we didn't even know at the time that it was like a terrorist attack, you know?
Right.
So... I'm standing there with an M16 on the fence line. The Venturous was docked up at the time right there, and they got their 50s manned. And I'm just like, this is crazy. And then someone came up to me and was like, hey, you need to get down to Cortez. You guys are getting underway. So I like hauled ass in my car over the Skyway Bridge, got to Cortez. We sat under the Skyway Bridge for like 2 days, on the 41, just anchored with the 240s mounted and just sitting there like, what's going on? You know, everybody at the time, they thought they were going to be attacking bridges and
landmarks. Yeah, everything was like, what's going to happen next?
Yeah.
I remember that feeling.
They locked the port down. The port was closed. So it was like no boats coming in or out. So then after that, they basically were like, did the Sea Marshal program, which eventually like became VBSS. So I was part of that. And they were like, they had us training with like SWAT guys, and we were doing CQC. And it was just crazy because they didn't know what direction like the Coast Guard was going to kind of go in.
Right.
Obviously, a lot of that chilled out when it became VBS and the MSRT and MSSTs and EMIST and all that stuff happened. And at the time, I really wanted to get into that program, but ITB called, and I mean, that's MTB
that's,
now.
Yeah, that's one that you don't pass up.
Best job.
Best
telling
job
you,
ever.
Best job in the Coast Guard, hands down, if you can get that job.
It's a secret stuff.
Yeah, it's horrible.
Actually, you're right. It was the worst 3 years of my life.
Yeah, God.
All 35 countries I went to, it was terrible. Okay.
Tell us a horrible story about what was your favorite country you went to?
So
can't be a drinking story.
You just can't concentrate on the drinking.
No, it's what was cool about it was that you traveled as a civilian, you know, khakis and a polo shirt. We got a uniform. I don't know if they still give the allowance, but you could buy suits. You had to buy suits, you know. So they gave us, like, I think it was like $2,500 clothing allowance to go out and buy, like, all that stuff. We had, like, Samsonite luggage and, you know, frequent flyer miles. You're staying in, you know, Marriott's and four-star hotels for the most part. Djibouti, you stay in a Connex box, you know.
You stay in the nicest hotel in town, whether the nicest hotels are Kent or Marriott.
You're right. You're right. I will say my favorite place, and it's a place that I would actually like to go back to, was Madagascar.
Really?
Yeah, and we stayed in this really cool resort, and it was like open air huts, basically.
Right.
But like at the foot of my bed was a volcano. Like, just,
that's awesome.
Yeah. And I stayed, and I had the mosquito netting over me, which nobody else brought, and they laughed at me until the next morning. When they were all covered in mosquito bites.
And they have malaria and you're still rocking.
Yeah. Well, no, you're taking the big green pills. Yeah, you're not getting malaria.
Did you ever have any dreams on those pills?
In the beginning, yeah. No, yeah, you have like hallucinations more than dreams. But I actually stopped taking them.
Oh, really?
And my thing was there's quinine and tonic water, so gin and tonics do the same thing.
Oh, nice.
I did the old British South Africa method of anti-malaria. Right. And it worked. Yeah. And my liver is not as destroyed as it would have been on the malaria.
That's fair.
Yeah, I remember the first time I ever took one, I'm laying in bed, and I remember I was asleep, right? And then all of a sudden, like, I felt myself get up, and it was like a snake was coiled at the end of my bed. And I got in, like, the high guard for this thing. And then I woke up, and I'm like, what am I doing? You know, like, looking around.
In
like,
fairness, there could have been a snake.
I was going to say,
if you asked me, I would have been like, there was a snake at the foot of my bed.
There was a story of, it wasn't my trip, but I had heard about a guy right before I got there who, like, got naked and ran out of the hotel into the street, like, hallucinating.
Yeah, I believe
it's no drinking involved.
No, that was actually malaria pills.
Those malaria pills, man, are no good.
I don't know. I took them. I didn't have any effects.
You didn't have anything?
No.
Man,
I guess it's different for everybody. Yeah. I hallucinated. Like, my dreams were very vivid, like, super crazy. We did have a guy that got bit by a spider and it, like, laid eggs in his leg.
Oh,
So, like, I had to get, like, ice bring this little med kit, and I had a scalpel in there, and he was like, dude, you got to, because he's like, there's something hard in my leg, and I'm like, oh, dude, I bet there's eggs in there, and he's like, you got to cut them out, and I was like, I'm not trained to do that shit. We were in Africa, and it was like
you were the better option.
And this was where we were in Sao Tome, which another place, by the way, is incredible, like magical place. This place was like it almost like untouched by civilization. Like, you know what I'm saying? It's old school plantations, cocoa plantations. The people were amazing, and it was like just like the wildlife and everything. It's like just jungles everywhere. Like I couldn't believe it. It was just like this place is so cool. But unfortunately, the animals were also
big and scary. Untouched by people.
Yeah. So everything was like gigantic. Every bird was like, oh, that's not a bird. That's an insect. But he got the eggs, so I had to cut those out of his skin, which was gross. And then I also got bit on the face by a spider. And you could see the two marks, and my face swelled up. Like, I had a reaction to it.
Wow,
so I was like,
man.
Oh, God, what's wrong with my face? So they were like,
did you wake up like that?
Yeah.
Awesome.
The next morning, they all looked at my face, and they were like, oh, maybe you don't have to go to class today. And I was like, I need some Benadryl.
Benadryl cured everything.
We had guys in a country when there was a coup.
Right.
And they were like locked down in a hotel, like hanging out with the deposed president. Like, that's cool. We had there was a picture of Master Chief Nina Cicinelli, and they blew up a hotel. There was like a bomb that went off in the hotel where they were at, and you see her like running, and then captured her in the paper.
Yeah.
Like sprinting out the door. Like,
I think they're a lot more risk averse now. Like, stuff still happens, but I don't think it quite gets like that anymore.
No. And
occasionally. But
I mean, the thing is, when you're in some of these countries, you don't know when stuff happens, you know what I mean?
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, international training, they used to be the guys who, they did some stuff that wasn't so much training.
They were doing op evals. They were basically, if you heard of that book, Not Your Father's Coast Guard, I would like to plug that only because Matt Mitchell, the guy that wrote the book, was at ITD when I was there.
Oh, okay.
And he was doing all his Freedom of Information Act stuff to get all those files, which was amazing. The passion that he put into that book to get all those stories was awesome. But basically, these guys were going down to like Bolivia and South America, and you know they were doing like drug raids with the DEA, and it was crazy, like combat. It was essentially combat.
I actually know a guy who, and you might have served with him, Mario. I can't think of his last name.
Rente?
Yeah.
I was at ITD with Mario
for my first time around in Yorktown, where he his wife thought he was dead for like 3 days. on one of those trips?
Trinidad and Tobago.
Is that where it was? Yeah.
Yeah, and funny story about that, I believe it was Trinidad. When I was going to Trinidad, I used to rock climb when I was active duty before I got hurt. And I was talking about climbing in Trinidad and how amazing, I'm like, there's so many peaks and so many things to climb there. And there's a lot of vegetation, so the climbing there is a little difficult, but he was like visibly upset. And he's like, you need to be careful. And like, I'm like, relax, dude. Like, you know, and Mario was one of the guys at ITE that I looked up to.
Right.
At the time, like, I was a BM2, just made BM1. He's this like salty BM, and he was, he was like our main force protection guy. He was the guy that had the kit that had everything. Like, if you needed anything and you were in the middle of the jungle, Mario would be like, I got it. Like, super survivalist, you know? And I learned all that from him. And he ended up sitting me down and telling me the story of how basically he was on a patrol boat. I think it was like old school.
Yeah,
it was like an 82, I think.
I heard the story at his retirement ceremony.
Yeah, they pulled in and they went hiking and they climbed and they just kept going and kind of like, oh, let's keep going. And they ended up, Mario fell and got injured and he couldn't walk. And again, I might be not exact on the story because he told me the story like 12 years ago.
Right.
But the guy that was with him was like, I'm going to go get help. And when the guy went to go get help, he fell and died. Like, he broke his neck. But it was like not even a quarter mile from where Mario was, but he had no idea.
Right.
And he was just there for days, just sitting there like dehydrating, you know, starving. Like, he's like, what the hell is going on? Nobody's coming. So eventually they did launch a search and rescue mission. I believe it was like a farmer that found him.
Right.
You know,
but I know like his wife, like,
oh, yeah,
legitimately, like, they told her, yeah, he's,
yeah, the Coast Guard thought,
missing an
the Coast Guard thought he was like dead pretty much. Yeah. It was like a body recovery at that point.
Wow.
And they found him like barely clinging on to life. And,
right.
And it was just an amazing story to hear, but I was like, wow, man, like, that's crazy.
That definitely made you a prepper. Like, right. Survive something like that.
Right. Oh, yeah.
And he already kind of was.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, and it's like funny because I look back to it, and it's funny you brought him up because I think about like what made me that way.
Right.
And I'm still like that now. Like, everything is, I have like all my little kits for everything. And I like, nope, him and this guy, James Maggard, who's an MK. It's like James Maggard and Mario Rente, man. They turned me into like this prepper, like always be ready, always have all this stuff. And I will say it kind of curtailed into saving my career in the Coast Guard because I as you guys know, you know, there's a nickname for a guy who's into a lot of gear.
Right.
We won't say it on here.
Right.
But,
yeah.
Yep. Gotcha. It rhymes with gear.
Right.
And I was that guy and I always loved like gear and equipment. Like, after I left that unit, when I went to the Middle East, it was like, you know, I want all the guys to have the best stuff to do these boardings out in the Middle East, you know, and like, I carried like all kinds of crazy stuff, probably stuff that I didn't need to carry. We joke around in the DSF community, is like, in the beginning, you want to molly like everything to your vest, but then as you actually operate, you take crap off.
Right.
And the dudes that have been doing it for a while, you have like bare minimum on your kit.
I think of this scene in Platoon. Remember the movie Platoon?
Yeah, yeah.
Where Charlie Sheen's like passed out from all the stuff he's carrying, and the sergeant's like, well, you don't need that. You don't need that. You don't need that.
Yep.
I'll carry the rest of this for you.
Yeah. So I got into the gear, and then when I was at Miss New York, you have to, FP teams at the time, they're gone now, but you had 12 guys. So
right.
You had to have everybody, collateral supported the team. You didn't have a support element. So I became the gear cage guy. And I always wanted to make sure we had the best stuff. You know, before the UAL, each team could kind of have what they wanted.
Merry Christmas.
Yep.
Merry Christmas. That was
We've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor. We're going to give you a key number about the future National Coast Guard Museum, and that number is 5.
There are 5 themed storylines: lifesavers around the globe, enforcers on the seas, defenders of our nation, champions of commerce, and protectors of the environment.
The exhibits and galleries in those storylines will be showcased in a 5-story museum.
And here's our favorite 5. For as little as $5 a month, you can be a plank owner and support construction of the National Coast Guard Museum.
For details on how you can get involved, go to coastguardmuseum.org/out. That's coastguardmuseum.org/OUT.
That was
yep.
Nice team.
Not saying we had a big budget, but big budget.
Yep.
So, made it rain.
Yeah, so we bought a lot of cool stuff and useful stuff. I wasn't just like, oh, let's just molly this because we need it. I mean, it was,
right.
You know, really, I wanted the guys to be the safest possible.
Mm-hmm.
What I would say the most tragic point of my career was Sean Lynn dying in 2010. I was his first/team chief, and I was at BTOC with him. Okay. We were going through the basic tactical operators course, for those that don't know what that is. At the time, it was the essentially what you had to get through to be on a team. Mm-hmm. And that's where you got your close quarters combat training and all your range and marksmanship and all that stuff. Fast roping, hook and climb.
Right.
So when we were there, my team had already qualified us in fast roping, but we hadn't gotten a chance to do hook and climb. So when we were doing it at BTOC, my team was actually, at the time, Miss New York was deployed to CENTCOM.
Okay.
So there was only like five or six of us back, and I had just got to the unit. So they were like, hey, you're going to BTOC. And when I went, we were doing, they don't do hook and climb and fast rope at BTOC anymore, to my knowledge. In fact, I don't even think they do BTOC anymore. I think now it's just called Tactical Operators Course.
I'm not sure.
I heard, and it's What's all that? Just one,
yeah, I'm not sure.
It's all just one course, and it's like everything. So we were doing at the end, hook and climb, fast rope, and pretty much by then you like feel like a rock star. You've been through all this CQC training, all the dudes training you were like Green Berets and SEALs, and you're just like high-fiving each other, you know. Well, back then the water survival program was not as robust as it is now. I would say it was a little bit more reactionary.
Right.
A good example, one of the things I thought was stupid, you used to jump in the water, right, and they make you tread with all your gear on.
Right, I remember that.
And it was like 2 minutes of treading with gear on, and a lot of the teams would even increase that time. And I'm like, this is what, we have all this flotation, why are we treading? Why are we not immediately activating our flotation? Like, this doesn't make any sense. But it was more of a gut check too,
right.
Which, you know, obviously in a new special ops type program, there's a lot of gut check that goes on. So we did this, did their water survival program or whatever, and then went through BTOC. Sean, unfortunately, had fallen on hook and climb into the water, could not activate his, or he activated his TFS at the time. Turned out there was no air in his TFSs.
Right.
Which is basically like, for anybody that knows, like a belt-mounted life jacket that you had to manually activate.
Yep.
They
were like little
kidney beans,
and
they
would float up under your arm,
yeah.
And they would hold you in all your equipment. He tried to release his gear. At the time, hook and climb policy, you would run a runner up through your kit,
mm-hmm.
And the old kits used to release from the center. So they saw him pulling, of course, we don't know this for a fact, but they believe he was pulling his runner instead of his cable release. His cable release was pulled, but he was a short, real stocky guy. He was an arm wrestler, he was a big kid. And when he pulled to his arm extension, but the cable was longer. So the cable didn't release. Now we have all these policies that fix all these things.
Yeah.
And I remember it used to be, like you used to, even if you pulled it from here, you would activate and you'd go up to the with your arms and then you still had to like give another jerk
right.
to get it good.
Yeah, now it's like,
gear,
yeah.
So
it's super easy.
Auto-inflate, I think you have to be auto-inflate now.
Now they're auto, but you can, depending, like when you're in the helicopter, they're actually manual because you
safety.
Don't want them in auto if you
right.
if you flip in the helo. But yeah, so it's but then now you're asking a member to remember, hey, you just did fast roping, tomorrow you're on a boat,
right.
Put it back in auto. So again, the water survival program now has, I was a water survival master after the fact, but unfortunately, basically I lost one of my teammates that night. He drowned in the Chesapeake. Really, really difficult time for the team, for me. The Coast Guard did the right thing afterwards, and they really looked at, first of all, they let us continue the school, which to me was amazing. The
yeah.
Coast Guard actually allowed a school to continue where a member died in training.
Mm-hmm.
And they let us graduate BTOC, probably one of the highest graduation rates after that. Obviously, everybody was pretty motivated to pass. Went back to my unit. They stood us down. Eventually, they built the units back up, and they built the new water survival program, which was pretty good. After that point, I kind of made it my mission to go, that's never going to happen again.
Right.
Like, none of my guys are ever going to get lost again based on gear. Or equipment
right.
and failures.
Right. I mean,
so
we
I,
do a job where it can happen, but
there's
good, not good, but there's reasons that are acceptable and reasons that are unacceptable.
It's not going to be equipment related.
Right.
So I went crazy with the equipment. I helped the Coast Guard, the dog at the time with the UAL, and just as much input as I could put in. I just really wanted to manage the program, but at the time I was just about to make chief. That's not, you know, something
right.
that's going to happen. Kind of neat that I ended up at MSRT, made it through Green Team. Found out when I was at ATOC that I had a fractured C5 vertebrae from fast roping that got X-rayed or MRI'd, but nobody ever like told me. Pretty cool. So made it through Green Team with a fractured
shock on our faces.
Yeah, right.
Made it through Green Team with a fractured spine.
Talk about real fast. What so the Miss Team post 9/11 anti-terrorism team, does port security mainly, pretty much primarily, right? Some law enforcement support to the sectors, yep, in different areas. MSRT, what do they do?
MSRT is a higher tier team. They basically do, you know, direct action, active shooter, that kind of stuff. It's counterterrorism, but it's at a higher level. They have K-9, they have precision marksmen, they have, you know, a full Saberni, chemical, biological, nuclear element that can respond to a full Saberni threat, but actually operate with inside a contaminated area, which I think they're the only team in the U.S. arsenal that can do that. As far as, like, you know, there's guys that do Saberni, and then there's guys that operate, but there's not, like, that level of both. And these guys, you know, they have an incredible amount of training, and that's an element of MSRT, of course. And then we have the TDT, tactical delivery, which, you know, is our boat element.
Right.
And those guys, again, same thing, killer boats. I mean, the boats are incredible they have there. Top-level training.
What boats did you have when you were there?
I can't.
The 33s that were, like,
it was before
off?
They had the spec LEs that were, yeah, sliced, but before that they had, and I should have paid more attention to the boat name, but it was basically like, looked kind of like a seal boat. It was basically this giant rib, and it had four outboards, and
I've seen that.
All the seats are shock loaded, yeah, so it's like you basically put the whole team in the back, and I was on them, but at that point I was so far out of the bosun mate world, and
right,
I knew I'd want to drive it if I asked too many questions, so I kind of just was like, I'm not looking at the boat.
This is just a taxi for me.
Yeah, yep. I'm never going to get to drive one of these things. I made that choice.
Right.
But yeah, so it was when I got hurt, they were like, what are we going to do with you? And they wanted to med. They actually, the Coast Guard tried to med board me at 18 years, which is crazy. I'm like, I'm 2 years from retirement. You're going to med board me. No. I will say MSRT stood up for me. They wrote a letter to PSC saying, we want to keep this guy. He's got a lot of experience. We can find a job for him. Basically, they kind of put me in the job that I always wanted to do, which was like the DSF equipment guy.
Right.
So I took over the MSRT's warehouse, and I basically worked with a civilian that was there on the UAL. And at the time, MSRT West hadn't stood up. So
the UAL is unit allowance list. Yeah. So it's basically all the gear that you're going
to
get.
You're allowed to get.
And for the team, and yep, yeah, the stuff that, yeah, you're allowed.
So I started really revamping the UAL, and like, the lights that we used on our weapons, and like the uniforms, the type of uniforms with the cry, and all. I mean, it was just cool because I had like the boots we wore. I had so much input into it.
Yeah,
like, I went from being like,
it's like an outsized impact for like,
yeah,
what your pay grade
of course
is. That's a hugely
and
outsized
then
impact.
Pretty much making sure all the guys got the right gear.
Right.
Well, especially,
you know,
when you've seen an equipment failure with, you know, cost of life basically, right?
Yeah. So, yep, and I hung Chum's picture up in the shop. I had it framed in the shop, and it was a reminder every day that, like, when I'm there, these guys are going to have every damn thing that they need. And I fought, and you know how it is with logistics. A lot of, well, why do they need that? Well, because they do. You know what I mean? Like, you have to justify, well, I can get this cheaper. Why don't they use this? Because it's cheaper and it's not as good.
Right.
And I would
in some cases, you get what you pay for.
Right, and it was nice, and the operators enjoyed having an operator in supply,
right,
that they could come to and be like, yo, we're going to CENTCOM cheap, we need this. Like, and I would be like, let's do it. And I would, right, I would go to bat. And it was cool because the command would listen to me too, and I would come to them and go, hey, we should get this, it's safer for the guys, it's lighter weight, you know what I mean? And then they would be like, okay, sounds good, chief, buy it. Like, so it was a cool job, and it kind of like, even though it wasn't, you know, the rock star operating like I was doing before, it was really neat to be able to give back to the team and work with the guys on that policy level, you know, especially only as a chief.
Yeah, no, you're having a huge impact.
And then they allowed me to sit till, you know, my 20 and retire out of that job, which was pretty cool.
Yeah, very cool. Do you know Sean Lawler?
Yeah, of course.
Curious.
Oh, yeah. He's at
Fish School. Yes.
Fish School in Charleston.
Yes.
Yeah, he actually, so it's funny, he has a tactical jet.
Oh, yeah.
The patches, yeah. And we just talked about getting those in the shop here.
Did you? Nice.
Yeah, and a pale horse, of course. Yeah. We want to have him in our shop because I was like, oh, dude, you got to put it in there.
Well, Sean, he's going to be an entrepreneur, man, one day.
Yeah. Oh, he's great.
Yeah, he'll fall in line. So let's go back to story time real fast. First SAR case ever.
First SAR case.
First case, it could be anything.
Man, I was at E2, literally on the boat for 3 days of me reporting the Ventress that got underway.
Right, typical.
Yeah,
typical.
Like 3 days. So I got there, everybody was on stand down, 72s before they leave.
Right.
So I got there, and of course everyone's like, yeah, we're getting underway in 3 days. And I'm like,
they're like,
what?
Here's your rack.
Yep.
We'll see you in 3 days.
Pretty much. So we got underway. We had been underway for maybe 3 or 4 days. So now I'm like at a boot camp, a total of like a week.
Right.
And the HSC, his name was Julio Galvan, this guy. Or not HSC, it was HS2, it was independent duty.
Yes.
And he went down in this Boston Whaler that we had found with the SAR case. And this guy sliced his Achilles tendon open, like in half, with a fillet knife. And yeah, and I was standing there on the boat deck, and he looked up at me, and he was like, "You get down here, put pressure on this." And I'm like, "What?" So like, I climbed down the Jacob's ladder and like grabbed this like gauze, and I'm like, his Achilles tendon's like, you know, squirting out of his leg. I'm like, "Oh my God, this is so crazy." There's blood all over the deck of the boat, and I'm just thinking like, here I am.
Right, the Coast Guard. This is why I'm on the Coast Guard.
This is it. Yeah. So it was like that was my first case, and it was like 7 days out of boot camp. So,
that's awesome.
Like it was that awesome. Wild. Yeah. Right.
And
that was pretty cool.
And then you got off that boat, and somewhere a BM-1 or a chief went, "Aren't you there for watch?"
Go break in on help. Right. You know, help look out.
First case is a coxswain.
Oh man, I'm trying to think what my first case is a coxswain was. It was a tow. It was pretty lame. It was just a tow.
Yeah, just a tow. Yeah. Disabled boat, brought it back.
Yeah.
Didn't break anything or. Yeah.
Nah, it was easy.
Sweet.
Easy day.
Was it on 41? Because that was.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You're driving a tow truck.
Stern tow in from Tampa Bay, come into the inlet there by Cortez, put him inside tow, take him to the dock, a longboat key, you know, over the moorings. Easy day.
Easy day. What about, let's see, first time you ever put somebody in handcuffs?
Fisherman.
What do you do?
Warrant. He had a warrant. Yeah. And he was, it's actually funny. I always say like, man, this guy must've been arrested so many times. Cause as soon as I asked him his name, of course they give you like a fake name. And then I'm like, I need to see some ID. So eventually he gave me some ID. I actually kind of bullshitted him. I was like, "Hey, look, man, I don't know if you're an illegal immigrant. If you don't give me an ID, I'm gonna have to take you to INS for holding." And he's like, "What?" And I was like, "Yeah, I mean, you could be an illegal immigrant. I don't know that. Like, I need to prove your citizenship." So he's like, "Oh, hold on, man." And he like went and got his ID card. And I'm like, I totally smoked that guy.
Yeah.
But he gave me his ID and then I ran it. And we used to have those pagers that you could run, FDLE pagers in Florida.
Okay.
They were like
Yeah, I remember them. I've seen them.
Yeah, like a little pager. Yeah, they were super old school. It was like a text pager and you could run warrants through it. So like I punched him through and he had a warrant. So I called up and they were like, "Yeah, we're gonna take him." So I was like, "Okay." So I was like, "Sir, do you have a warrant?" And he was like, "Yep." And I was like, "Okay." And he goes like this, "I got you." And he turned around and he literally got into the handcuffing position. And I was like, "What? Wow, this is like doing it at school."
Yeah,
like,
I don't even know what to do. Right? You made this so easy.
I was like, "Wait, because he did it." And then I'm thinking like, "All right, I know the commands in order." And he just jumped ahead. So now I got to like. Going through the commands in my head.
It's
then,
like singing the ABC song.
Yeah. So I went through, cuffed him. He was super cool, man. We put a vest on him, and he was. I was like, "Hey, you know, I'm just doing my job." And he's like, no, "I'm not mad at you, man. You gotta do what you gotta do." So yeah, that was awesome. Pretty cool. We had a couple rough ones. We had a couple guys that we had to wrestle down at Cortez. We had a. I'll never forget the guy. He was like a. I think he was like a pro wrestler. But he was a fisherman,
right?
And he was huge. And at the time, the BM-1, he was BM-2 that made BM-1, had to like baton this guy. And the guy was like, he was like on a chain. He's like, and he's like, and he's wailing on. And the guy was just like, and I'm thinking like, "Oh my God, this guy."
This is a guy who's had like ladders smashed.
And I was like, "Oh my God, this is gonna turn into like a W. He's gonna turn on this guy, Tony, the BO, and I like just throw him over." And Tony was like super tall, super skinny.
Right.
Eventually, he did go down, and they cuffed him, and they had to use two sets of cuffs because his arms were so big.
Yeah.
He couldn't get him behind his back, but it was just funny.
That's awesome. It's good. Yeah. I remember whenever you're talking about you're waiting for that moment on that first time to handcuff somebody and you want to give the commands, make sure you do it all right. I saw one guy in Miami one time and he talked him through straight textbook on the end of this dock. And dude, 10 minutes later, like, this guy's still not in handcuffs. I'm like, "Dude, you better get the guy in handcuffs."
Yeah.
He's like, "All right,
he's like, widen your stance. Nope. Right? Widen your stance.
The whole way.
A little wider.
Yeah. Put your toes out more.
Yep, spread your fingers. The waist.
Come on. No, that's good. Well, hey, Mike, we appreciate you sharing your stories, man. Yeah. Tell us about what you're into these days.
So, on retirement, basically, when I was sitting at a desk at MSRT, told you I've always been an entrepreneur. Loved radio. I was a DJ as a hobby. Got into DJing on Hot 100, Max Media here in Hampton Roads. Really just got into broadcasting and loved it. during that time, I kind of, I've always been a cigar and coffee guy. Obviously, as Bosemates, what do we love? Coffee, right? And like you said, we don't really have a taste for good coffee.
Yeah, it's the best coffee in the world sometimes.
It's got to be black and don't wash my mug, right? So I got into coffee at ITD from traveling, good coffee, and picked up a taste for, you know, French press and pour overs and Italian roast and all this stuff.
Which is kind of funny, man, because some of the places that ITD goes, like, yeah, but even you're if talking about Nesty, you know, like the Nesty.
Nescafe.
Funny, because
I also got a taste for instant coffee that way.
Nice,
and I still drink it occasionally, and my fiance thinks I'm crazy for drinking instant. She's like, you own a coffee company, why are you drinking instant coffee? And I'm like, it's different, and I like it. But I got into coffee, and of course, cigars were always something that bonded, everybody bonded, right? Somebody has a baby, you have a cigar. Somebody gets married, you have a cigar. You're deployed with the boys, you have a cigar. Like, that's just our time. So I always said, I want to do a cigar shop. And I said this my whole career, I'm going to do a cigar shop one day. So when I was in the nightlife industry as a DJ, I got the opportunity to meet some cigar industry people. And I basically, of course, what can I do to get in this industry? Like, sell cigars, like, you know, get a license and OTP license called Other Tobacco Products here in the state of Virginia and sell cigars. And I was like, all right, I'm gonna do it. So at the nightclubs I was at, I would actually sell cigars. Like, I'd be DJing and I would get a girl that I knew from like a waitress or a bartender, be like, hey, if you're off tomorrow, meet me at the club, you're gonna go on the patio, I'm gonna have you sell some cigars. Cool. And it worked, and I would sell like a lot of cigars that way. And then I just kept going and going and grinding at it till eventually the cigar and coffee thing became more of a love than the DJ thing. Mm-hmm. And I actually, when I did retire from the Coast Guard, decided to go brick and mortar, opened up Primo Cigars and Coffee, which you're sitting in now, and here we are. Yeah. And I actually retired as a DJ. I did my last show this summer at Lunacy down at the beach, Virginia Beach, and just kind of like, you know, put that behind me. I got a 2-year-old. It's just too much being at the club till 3-4 in the morning.
It's the hours, right?
Yeah, and then I got to come in here and open up the next day, and it's like, that. You know, I'm at this point now, I'm you know, 41 years old, I'm like, this is where my focus is, this is my future.
I just see 16 years from now, when that kid's 18, you're gonna be back at it. I feel it.
No. Then it's creepy at that age, when you're in the club.
I like you do it, man. So you're like costume or something.
Yeah, like, how old is that DJ? He looks super old and weird. Right. But no, so I got linked up with Pale Horse Coffee, which was great at the time. They were Seaside and Seabag Locker Coffee, and they were the guy who owned it at the time was a retired Navy commander, and his wife was a retired chief, and they were basically running this coffee company, and I shouldn't say he was retired, he was about to retire, and when he did retire, he wanted to relocate to Hampton Roads. So I was like, cool, man, like, we should link up when you get here. And I was selling his coffee out of the shop pretty successfully. And he merged with an existing company called Pale Horse Coffee. And the one of the owners was locally. He was an Army 101st Airborne, Lieutenant Colonel, retired. And basically when they joined, they kind of were like, hey, we're looking for more partners. You already sell our coffee. Do you want to get in? So I went into the company. We picked up a fourth partner. We joke around, say we're the four horsemen, you know, for Pale Horse. Yeah. He's Air Force. So we have an Air Force, Army, Navy, and Coast Guard.
Very cool.
I'm the only prior enlisted.
Right, so you're doing all the work.
No. I joke around and I'm always like, I'm the one that keeps you grounded. If not, you guys would be a wardroom and the Good Idea Fairy would just be crazy in here. So, no, they're all great guys. Very, very intelligent, very good businessmen, all of them. I was very thankful that they brought me on. Yeah. And so we're opening up a roastery and coffee shop in Chesapeake, where Big Ugly Brewing used to be on South Battlefield. The grand opening is going to be Halloween. We actually were on the front page of the Virginia Pilot this morning.
Yeah, that's
for the article.
Very cool.
And then I'm continuing to sell Pale Horse. So I'm keeping the shop. Primo is a separate thing. You know, my love for tobacco and cigars is just insane. And I just love how it brings people together. So I decided to keep the shop, and then we sell Pale Horse here, of course, as well. So if you can't make it down to Chesapeake, you can pick up, you know, coffee here.
Awesome.
So how can they find you online?
So palehorsecoffee.com. You can go there. We actually do ship. We actually started out originally as an internet-based company, so we ship all over. Actually, a lot of my coasty friends that I kept into, like my buddy in Puerto Rico, he buys our coffee all the time. We ship, you know, all over the U.S.
What was this one again? What are we doing?
This is a Southern Whiskey.
Southern Whiskey. Highly recommended, man. Yeah, it's very good. Yeah.
We have 18 infused flavors. We have 8 different bean origins. We make, you know, seasonal flavors. We have a pumpkin cream pie that we just came out with for, obviously, the...
Yeah, it's first day of fall.
Pumpkin spice season.
Yes, there you go.
We did that. But it's, what's kind of cool is we're not just taking syrups and dumping it in your coffee like you go to some of these other places. We actually infuse it into the roast. Oh, so okay. When you get Southern Whiskey coffee, it's its own blend of coffee, which is cool.
We won't name any of the other chains.
Yeah.
You all know who we're talking about.
Yeah. Well, you know, other people. I almost said it. I was like, other people. So, so you can get that online. We also have what I think is cool. See the 6 bags right over there?
Yep.
You guys can't see, but they can see. It's called Coffee for a Cause. So what it is we have, we're trying to get 10.
I guess it doesn't matter, right? We'll just pick
one. Grab first. Well,
you
yeah, that's
grab two of them. That's, how about that? Is that good?
Perfect. So this is Hunter 7. Hunter 7 is basically provides medical treatment to people from the burn, like veterans that are not getting medical coverage from the VA for things like from the burn pits. So what happens is we do 50% of the money from that bag of coffee goes to that charity.
Wow, huge.
So we actually make it for them. Boot campaign, as you can see, it says Lace Up America. This is basically life improving programs for veterans and military families. So it's like a military family support program.
Very cool.
Also do First Bite, which is the Military Working Dog Association. Pennies for Quarters, which is a homeless veterans organization. And then two that are local, Climb 4, which is a really neat charity. They take veterans with PTSD on hiking and backpacking and camping trips, and very they actually cool. provide them the gear to do it.
Oh, wow.
Leslie, the founder of that company, she's amazing. Basically, she had been given a bunch of equipment by EOD guys that she was friends with because of her own PTSD to go on this Adirondack Trail hike. She did like 2,000 miles. I forget what it was, crazy. She went on this and it changed her life. And she's like, I want to do this for other people. Right. So we made a coffee for her. It's a Honduran Mountain Roast coffee. And then Pennies for Paws, which is a local animal nonprofit. That's our only non-military charity right now.
I'd say that's a worthy one, though.
It is. And it's great. They do so much for, you know, for all of the different pet rescues in the area. So we're trying to eventually have 10 charities, 10 nonprofits.
Awesome. And all available online, right?
Yep. Very so you can get it all online right now. I think we're still doing the special. If you buy 3 of the nonprofit coffees, the Coffees for a Cause, you get 3 bags of coffee and one of those new Pale Horse mugs, the black and red mugs.
Very cool.
And it's like a $50 combo pack. So
cool.
Definitely something to check out.
Yeah, Mike, you're making moves, man. I love it. What a heck of a company portfolio. I think you got cigars and coffee, dude.
Yeah.
Oh, good. I mean, they really do.
Solid way to retire.
They do. And you know what's funny is I find in the business world, different than the military, we're used to just getting stuff done. You know,
right.
We get stuff done. Like,
we don't have any patience.
Yes. Yep. No. Everything's like yesterday. And I'll call some of these people in the civilian world and I'll be like, hey, when can we meet up? They're like, well, maybe like next week. And I'm like, what about this week? Why not now? Like, what are you doing right now?
What are you
now?
Doing right this second?
Yes. Like, and it's just very like, the sense of, what I find is that the sense of urgency a lot of times it's just gone in the civilian world, especially like on a Friday, trying to get anything done. Everyone's already at the weekend, and I'm like, we still got 3 hours left in the business day. Let's do this.
Nice.
So
nice.
I'm.
You spent a tour at a training center. You know it exists in the military world too. Let's be honest.
Well, also too is like even the DSF. It's like you do things like you'll be at the range and they'll be like, "Go do this. You got 1 minute," and you're like, "You can get a lot of stuff done in
a
minute."
It's amazing what you can. Yeah.
Yeah, you can get a lot of stuff done in a minute. So when I see people, and it's like, you know, it's like 2 hours before the end of the workday, and they're like, "Oh yeah, we'll just do this just on Monday." And I'm like, "What?" So I'm learning that transition from being, you know, and luckily my partner here, I'm located inside Southern Eats, which to give them a plug, awesome Southern food restaurant. Brian,
they're not open today, but I smell it, right?
Like Monday. And I was gonna say that's leftover from yesterday from our brunch. Monday is our closed day, obviously.
Right.
And Brian is a retired senior chief in the Navy. Awesome guy, worked in aviation. You know, me and him are on the same page. So I do enjoy, that's like with Pale Horse, I enjoy working with other veterans because we all have that same just drive and, you know, mentality. So
Yeah, Mike, man, totally appreciate it. Thanks, please, guys, go visit Primo Cigars and Pale Horse Coffee, right? They'll be linked all over social media feeds, but obviously doing great things for a ton of charities, and then you're also supporting the veteran community. So, yeah. Mike, we appreciate it, man.
Thank
we,
you, guys.
We thank you for your service.
It's been an honor to be on the show.
Yeah,
anytime you guys want to host a show, a different spot, you can just meet here and do your show.
Yeah.
I may be your coffee sponsor.
There you go.
Most inmates need coffee.
They do. Well, we appreciate it, man. Thanks.
Before we end this, we want to give a plug for some people and organizations that we believe in. Another one to check out is the Always Ready Collective, which delivers art by and for some daring fighters of the sea. Head over to Etsy, Facebook, or Instagram and search Always Ready Collective to check out their Coast Guard and Maritime-focused tattoo flash, pinups, and propaganda. You won't be disappointed. Anyone who gets one of their designs inked on their body will get featured on their feed and can be sent a care package on the house. Find a design you like, some blank canvas, and get it done. Thanks for taking the time to listen.
If you like what this podcast is about and what we delivered, look us up at theyhadtogooout.com or your favorite podcast platform and like, comment, subscribe, and share so we can keep the momentum up and do bigger things going forward.
Look for a new episode every Sunday. Until then, fair winds and following seas.